Let's probably start. I think so, yeah. We have actually we have a lesson that is split in two parts, and I probably won't give you the coffee this morning. I mean, the sense that in the between I have to make some communication for the Moodle site, so probably we use that interval to explain. Okay, you will have coffee at 11. No problem. Okay, so this lesson is split in two, because this one, I mean, the part one is actually the continuation of what we talked about last week. And this is a kind of novel story that we start. So it's no way to make different. So. Okay, so last week we actually discussed the composition of human genome, in some sense not really in depth, but actually we tried to revise some concept of linked to the structure of the different sequences that are composing our genome, and then also make a very small and quick overview of a comparative genomics. We are back now. And what I wanted to explain today is just what happened after the Human Genome Project. So at the completion of the Human Genome Project in 2003, I told you that actually the sequence was complete in 95%, because there were still gaps of repetitive sequences that we didn't know how to manage with. And there were several international consortia starting very important projects in that period. And they were dealing with, first, with the comparative phylogenesis. So they, as I told you already, they started with very different sequencing projects from different organisms. You had already a preview of how many of those we are sequencing today. And this also very, very fundamental project, that is the human genetic variation problem. So the idea was, of course, to study genomes in individuals. Okay, so we know that we are not all the same. So to estimate how much variation exists in between the different individuals, how they spread around the world in different groups, and importantly, which variants of the genome are linked to disease. Okay? So try to understand whether, for example, we have particular variants, small variants in our genome, that can predispose to the acquisition of disease. Okay, we know several of those that are actually linked, like, I don't know, Alzheimer's, diabetes, and a lot. The number is really very high. So this was the GWAS project, that means genome-wide association studies. So association between variants and phenotype, okay? And finally, gene expression and phenotype. So to study how the phenotype of cells, individuals, organs, tissue types, and diseases correlates with how genes are expressed. Okay, so very different projects, okay? And then in parallel, several projects of functional genomics started as well, but we talk on this in the next lesson. Okay, so today we concentrate on those first genetics, let's say, projects. So fundamentally, the most important were human genetic variation and genetic analysis of disease. Okay, at least from the human point of view, of course. So genetics means to evaluate variations. What is variation? Variation is, first of all, single nucleotide polymorphisms. That means only changes concerning one nucleotide at a time. Okay? So these are the most common variants in the genomes, not only in human genomes, but in everywhere, okay? So small variations. And the second class are called collectively indels, staying for insertion and deletions, okay? And when you look at the indels, means that fragments of DNA can be lost or acquired. They can be as small as one nucleotide, okay, or as large as thousands of nucleotides, okay, so patches of sequences that are lost or gained, okay. The third kind of variation that the genomes display is CNV, standing for copy number variations. We have several loci in our genome, as well in genomes of other organisms, in which sequences that can be as short as three nucleotides or two or one microsatellite, but as long as millions of bases, that can be repeated. And the number of these repeats varies among individuals. Okay? So this is called copy number variation. And finally, what you studied already last week, transposable elements. That, as you remember, sometimes they jump in different places of the genome. Okay? So in between individuals, we can occasionally find line 1, sign, L1, or whatever else that are placed in a small, slightly different places. Okay? Okay, the variants are not all linked to very evident phenotypes. Some of them are, for example, the color of eyes or the color of hair. Okay, these are variants in genes that determine a very evident phenotype. Okay, but most of these variants have no evident phenotype. So we don't know what they do, but they exist. Okay. Some of the variants are clearly associated to specific pathologies or to the predisposition to get some pathology. Okay. And what we think today is that many of the variants that have no evident phenotype, they work together. Okay. So you need several variants. They are associated weakly with the phenotype, but they require other variants to express the phenotype itself. Okay? We call them combinatorial association between variants, and this is a completely new field because it requires a number of studies. It's not enough to have hundreds of individuals to associate combinatorial variants. You need many, many, many more, so the task is really difficult. Okay, so the principal projects that are underway to describe variants associated to risk of disease are, I told you already, these genome-wide association studies, and actually they are run not by only one consortium, but they, for each disease, consortia exist to study particular association with variants. Okay, so of course, when the project started, so in 2003, I recall to you that this is they had only the Sanger sequencing, okay. So when they started this kind of projects, they were prospecting very small numbers of sequencing. Okay, for example, one of those projects was called the 1,000 human genome, and they say, okay, it will probably need 20 years to have these 1,000 genomes, but just because they were doing with the Sanger technique. Okay, so when we had these next generations, did you talk about NGS with Cordero last time? Started. Okay, no problem. But anyway, we will go through in a correct way. So anyway, when they started this next generation sequencing, it's a it was a really revolution, in the sense that the time required fall down from several months to 3 days to get a genome sequenced. So of course the prospectus changed completely, and all this project benefited a lot from this kind of sequencing, and they could accomplish all the sequencing in a very short time. And this was just to show you a report that was in January 2008. Actually, the first machine appeared in 2005. For example, several biotech companies like Illumina, the one that I asked you in the test last week, or the other one was the Roche 454, another kind of machine, they appeared in an experimental way in the big institute like Sanger Institute and so on in 2005. But the first report of sequencing of genomes, expression and so on, they appeared more or less roughly in 2007, 2008. So the first discussions that we had in the literature, in the journals, was around January 2008, in which people realized that this was really a potent tool to bring about all the sequences in a short time. Okay, so you will study with Cordero the details of how an NGS is made, okay, but just to be able to go through, the big difference is this one. There is no cloning. So remember that when you go to Sanger sequencing, you have to clone. So to make fragments, clone in plasmid, isolate, grow the fragment, and then sequence. So this makes a lot of difficulty, okay? With this NGS, you have no cloning step, okay? So you just take the starting material that can be DNA or RNA or whatever you will see, and you cut in small pieces, okay? That can be something like 200, 300, 500, the space, depending on the kind of experiment, okay? And then you take all these fragments that you have and you sequence them in parallel. Okay, so no cloning. Illumina uses a glass surface to put all these fragments, like trees in the forest. Okay, and then the sequences is made for all of them together. Okay, so you get a very complex image of this sequencing. Okay, it's a fluorescent-based technology. But you are sequencing millions of fragments together at the same time. This changes everything. Okay, instead of sequencing millions of fragments one by one, you sequence them together. Okay, so the machines of NGS, they work in this way. Okay, so we call high parallel sequencing. Okay, this is the way. You will see how to it works. And then what you get from, this is also an important point just to understand, is that when you make an NGS experiment, you get short sequence fragment, okay? So the machine gives you an enormous file full of data. There's millions of short fragments. Okay, these short fragments, the length of these fragments depend on the machine. The very first release of the, for example, the Illumina machine, it was something like 30 to 35 nucleotides long, so very short. Okay, now the machine evolved, and with the current version of the Illumina sequencing that we have, some of them exist in Torino. We have one in Candiolo, we have two or three in the NBC here, the Institute for Genomic Medicine. I mean, they are used around. You reach 100 and also 105, depending, 150, depending on the kind of experiment that you make, okay? This makes a lot of difference. I spent a few minutes on this, just making you thinking about it. Because what you have to do after the sequencing, okay, so you get millions of short fragments, what you have to do is to map them, to understand where they are from the reference genome. Okay? So you have the reference genome that have been produced by the Human Genome Project. Okay? You have fragments, you make what we call a BLAST, so a basic alignment. You will also learn this from bioinformatics. Okay? And each individual fragment is placed in a place in the genome. But we have just finished to say that our genomes are not the same. So you can have a sequence in the reference genome, but a different sequence in the fragment which represents it. Can you follow me? So in many cases, this is a real problem, especially as short is the read, as big is the problem of mapping. Okay? So with the machine we have today that are making fragments of 100 or so, this problem is better. I mean, it's solved better because when you have longer sequences, even if you have some SNPs, so if you have some variants or whatever, so you can confidently place the fragment in a certain position. Okay? Is okay? Any question? Have you got the point? Okay, good. So, the additional thing that we have to just to focus today is that this is a highly stochastic way to do. Okay, so you take, take a genome. Okay, so you take DNA from the person. Okay, from blood, for example, you extract DNA. Okay. So you will extract DNA from several cells, okay? Can you follow me? Probably you take, I don't know, you take 2 mL of blood, isolate the lymphocytes, and then make DNA extraction. You will probably have some thousands copies of the genome, right? Each cell has 2 genomes, so you get probably some 2 times 1,000 and so on, okay? And you make fragmentation of all of them. So it makes a lot of fragments, but you won't sequence all of them. You just take a sample of all these fragments, put in your machine, and sequence. Even if you produce actually millions of fragments, you never sequence all of them. So the choice is completely random. And it happens that some fragment of the genome is not covered by any of the fragments that you sequence. It happens. It depends on the depth, we say, the depth of the sequencing. And your result has a specific coverage. You will learn with Francesca Cordero what is a coverage. Okay? So with all this in mind, this is just to show you how it evolved. These are different machines. This is the Illumina one. This is the 454 of the Roche that was one of the first to appear in the market. Then there are other choices here. And you see this is the read length, so the length of each fragment you can sequence. And you see that for the Illumina, we started with 35. Now today, we can reach some of the machines, they can reach to 300. This is the length of the 45. So this in blue is the first version of each machine, and in red is adjourned in 2014. Now we have other version yet. Okay, and this is the maximum throughput, that means how many giga nucleotides you can sequence per run, so per experiment. So you, as you can see, for example, for the Illumina, you started with 1 gigabases, and now we are at something like 2,000 giga. It makes really a lot of sequencing per run. That means each experiment, you put the samples there, then push the button and wait for the sequencing. How long does it take? 3 days for a complete run of a sequence. Okay. Good. So this is also very interesting. The cost. The cost is something that's really fantastic. This is actually a slide that I took from the NCBI Human Genome Project on the web. And as you can see, this is, okay, this is dollar, this is a number, and this is million. Okay, so we started with, this is 2001, 2003, so the period in which actually the genome was sequenced in the first version, okay? And so look at the price. This is the cost per genome. So sequencing a genome at that period was something like $100 million each single genome. Then this is all the period of Sanger sequencing. The price decreased a little bit, 10 times. Because, why? Because the Sanger's machine were selling all around the world. It's like a price of a utilitary car or a Ferrari. Of course, there is a big difference. So when all the people buy this kind of machine, the price goes down. Okay. So when you arrive at that here, 2006-2007, a Sanger sequencing machine was much cheaper, the reagents were cheaper and so on, so you had a cost like 10 million per genome. But look at this. This is when the NGS appeared in the market. NGS means cutting, 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 cutting. Okay? And we are there. This arrives only to 2015. We are something like 1,000. This is 1K. $1,000 per genome. This is an affordable price. If you want to make your DNA sequences, you can go. I mean, is a real feasible thing. Okay, of course, this price is not the price that you can do in your lab. This is the price of running sequences in big genomic institute in which this machine runs all the day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So the cost of maintaining and buying the machine is divided by a number of stories. If you have your own machine, it will cost probably much more than that. But anyway, this is the situation. Okay, so this project started with the Sanger, but then moved to the NGS, and the most important projects are there. Okay, we talked already about GWAS. This is the 1,000 human genomes and the HapMap project that we're describing variation among genomes of individuals, okay, human. And the third one that we didn't mention till now is the Cancer Genome Atlas, also a very important project in oncology, in which people from almost everywhere in the world were collecting, you know that most of the tumors are operable. So the tumor is taken out of the patients and you have a small piece of the tumor that can be used for molecular analysis. And so these cells, these tumor cells were extracted, the DNA was sequenced, and so we have an idea of what kind of mutation were occurring in tumors and probably also an idea of which mutation can lead to the neoplastic transformation and progression. Okay, so this is the 1,000 genomes project. I hope to be able to make a quick tour on the site. I don't remember what I have next. Oh yeah, okay. Allah, yes. Come che si fa già che l'americano deve fare così. Non è successo niente. Nothing happened. Why? We don't know. Yeah. Okay, so this is the site of the project. There are what I wanted to show you is just that you have some home and about here. So I have no specific review for this first part of the course, talking about genomes and variation and whatever. So your textbook is actually what is written in the website. Okay, I will put the link somewhere in Moodle site. If you go there where there is about, you see there. Okay, about there is a small, it's not a kind of 2 pages description of what they did and which kind of results they got. Okay, so you can just read through. It's quite important, and is also somehow interesting to see. This is the map of sampling. I have a picture of that, so wait. We go back to the screen that is better. Okay. This is the first report they published in 2010, in which they were reporting for some, you see here, 179 individuals, okay, with some observation. And then finally they published another story here. That is, this is the final story in some way. You see, this is open access, so you can take it from the web. And I've been published in 2015, and we see here 2,500 individuals. So you can see that the goal, that was 1,000, you know, was passed by very widely because of this kind of NGS introduction. And we will read through the abstract just to understand something that is interesting. Okay, so... okay, I wanted just to show you something that they use. I probably put the abstract in a. Okay, here is the abstract, just to show you something inside. So we say here we report completion of the project, having reconstructed the genomes of 2,504 individuals from 26 populations. So they took samples all around the world to understand the variation. And using, this is something that I will tell you briefly, using a combination of different technologies. Okay. So the first one is low coverage whole genome sequencing. The second is deep exome sequencing. And third is dense microarray genotyping. Now, these are genetic terms, okay? And I won't spend time to explain you what they are, but then please look at these three labels that you find here. This is your duty. As I anticipate to you, in the Moodle site, you have a wiki that is called the methodological wiki. Okay? And when you see a label like this one on the slides, it means that this is a technology that you yourself you have to explain. Okay? So you will form small groups. This is open already, so when you go to the Moodle site, you find this three buttons. Okay, this is the group choice. So I made, I don't remember how many, I think 8 or something, groups. That means the first is NGS genetic analysis. The second one is, I don't remember what, fish technologies. Or the third is chip technologies and whatever. Okay, and then you can choose the group that you like more. Each of you, okay? And then you will try to contribute to the subject, okay? Making a small search in the literature or whatever, on the web, try to understand what it means, a term, and then putting a short text inside. This will be used by all of you to understand the meaning of a technology. Okay? This works as a wiki, a real wiki. So if, for example, you are writing something wrong, the next student can correct you and amend it, and erase and put another text in place or whatever. Okay? Here is a PDF file, how to use the wiki. Okay? So you can find instructions of it inside. And this is the student wiki itself. Okay? Again, there is a small text explaining you how to manage. Good. You are a little perplexed, looking at me in a strange way. No worry, it's not difficult to make. You can find all the information you want, starting from books to the websites, to Wikipedia, to whatever. Okay, you find the information you need. Okay. So anyway, just to make the story short, low coverage whole genome sequences mean to sequence all the genome, but not a very high depth. I mean, leaving very many interruptions, like holes that we saw before in the slide. Okay. This is low coverage genome sequencing. Then they did deep exome. What is an exome? Exome is only the part of the genome which encodes proteins. Okay? So since at the very beginning the cost of sequences was high, you remember, in 2000, and you remember the slide. So people tried to make the cost a little bit less. Okay, so instead of sequencing all the genome in a DNA, they choose to sequence only the exons, so only the part coding for proteins. And how to manage it is very easy, because there were companies selling microarrays that were able to select out of fragments of DNA, they were able to select only the parts of exons. Okay? So you select the fragments and then you sequence only the fragments selected. So this makes the story much smaller than all the genome. Okay? Of course, you get information only on the coding sequence. That's the problem. Okay? Anyway, they started to make also this one. And then this dense microarray genotyping you can select from the genome some markers here and around and there, so okay, to characterize the fragments. Since the genomes evolved not casually but in fragments, you can to interrogate each fragment. You can just select one small sequence. Okay, so this make this kind of microarray genotyping. Well, you will see in the explanation. But what is really now the information that you take home from this slide is if you continue reading this abstract, please. So this is the result. We characterized the broad spectrum of genetic variation. Okay. 2,500 individuals. In total, over 88 million variants. It makes really a lot. If anybody of you wants to, as usual, to divide the length of our genome by this, you can imagine that we have a variation very, very frequently in our genome. Okay? Of these 88 million variants, the largest part is single nucleotide polymorphism, so single nucleotide variants. Okay, you have 84.7 million single nucleotide variants. Then you have 3.6 million short insertion alteration, so what we call indels, and 60,000 structural variants. When you say structural, means the CNV, big fragments that are replicated, or something like this, or sequences like lines and signs that are moving through. Okay? All phased onto high quality haplotype. This is another mysterious story that probably is. Does anybody of you know what haplotype means? You don't. Okay, it's the story of the fragments. I told you the genome. You remember the homologous recombination during meiosis? Wherever you exchange, you exchange big fragments. Okay. So if you look at the human variation, you see that most of the humans have very similar patches of the chromosomes together that are in some way shuffled between them. Okay. But since the recombination is not a very easy event, most of, Italians have particular arrangements of the fragments. I don't know, a Chinese, another arrangement, or whatever. So you can characterize only small pieces of them. Okay, and these are called haplotypes. Okay. Why phased? Phased is another difficult story because, of course, when you get DNA from an individual, you have two genomes. One is of paternal origin and the other one is from maternal origin, okay? But actually you fragment them together. So when you fragment and then sequence, you don't know. They are not colored, so you don't know what is from father, what is from mother. And when you mount the sequence, you don't know where to place it, okay? There are special technologies that allow to reconstruct the phase, so if it comes from the paternal chromosome or if it comes from the maternal chromosome. And this is a very hard problem in bioinformatics, but they could reach this goal with almost all the structural variants. Okay, so this is the sampling, just going through quickly on this last part. So this is the population sampling, and they were actually circles in the original figure, I'm sorry. They were not eggs. Anyway, this is the color code. When you have colors going from orange to dark red, means that these are variants that are only limited to a special population. Okay? So this is the, for example, if you look at this, this is a sampling of Mexican people here. Okay? And if you take this, means that this number of variants, so you may estimate, I don't know, something like 15% or something like this. 15% of the variants that you find in Mexican people are limited to Mexican people. Okay? This is the other color, the dark gray, represents the number of variants that are shared across all continents, so you can find them wherever. You have the variants, but they are spread away. So they probably originated very, very early in the human history. Okay, and they kept alive. This yellow here is the private to continent, means that you can find variants, for example, here, that are found in all the population in America, but they are not present in any other continent. Okay? So, middle age, say. As a story, okay, and of course this light green is shared across continents. So, okay. They are present in at least two continents. This is the meaning. So, as you can see, this was a real big project going on. Okay, let's see another, only this part of the results, because it's really interesting. Okay, what they call a typical genome. So they are trying to make the story of a typical genome, making an average of all of them, okay? What is in a typical genome differs, we can just read through. Differs from the reference human genome, so what you find in NCBI data bank, something like 4 to 5 million sites. I'm not kidding. So you find differences of this number from the reference genome. Okay? So this explains also the difficulty I was saying about mapping short reads, because wherever you find differences, okay? 99.9% of variants consist of SNPs and short indels. Okay, short indels, again, I say that again, 1, 2, or 3, or 4 nucleotides insert or deleted from. Okay, so. But structural variants actually concern more bases overall, because when you look at the structural variants, I say it again, structural variants mean either copy number variations, so big parts that are repeated several times, okay, or transposable elements, okay. So if you sum all these structural variants that are only 0.1% total, but since they are long patches of sequences, overall they concern more nucleotides than the SNPs. Okay? Have you got the point? The typical genome contains an estimated 2,100 to 2,500 structural variants. So, on average, each of our genomes has this kind of number of structural variants. Of those, 1,000 are large deletions, so big patches of DNA that flux from some, as compared to the reference genome. 160 are copy number variants, so what I said just before. 915 on average ALU1 insertions. You remember the ALU are the small interspersed element. You remember? Last time we talked about. 128 L1 insertion. L1 are lines, so the long interspersed repeats. 51 SVA insertion, that you explained to me what they are on the exercise. And 4 NAMs. NAMs is an acronym of geneticist that stands for nuclear mitochondrial DNA segment. Sometimes in the nuclear genome you find patches of DNA that are derived from the mitochondrial genome. They are quite rare, as you can understand from the number of variations that are really low. Okay. And 10 inversion. Inversions means a patch of DNA that has been cut and inverted. Okay? Cut and inverted. And overall they affect 20 million bases of sequences. Okay? So this is the figure. So this is really what you have to take home as a message. Our genomes are really different from each other. And this makes a problem when you evaluate the variant, the structure, and the meaning in the terms of risk of disease and so on. Okay, the majority of variants in the data set are rare. So the majority of these small variants actually have a very low frequencies. Okay. You will see when you go to the informatic lab, you will see. In the table, most of them are very, very low frequencies, so they happen very rarely. 12 million have a frequency between 0.5 and 5%. Only 8 million of these variants have a frequency more than 5%. Nevertheless, the majority of variants observed in a single genome are common. Okay, so it means that if you look at the individual genome, like my genome, for example, you find that the majority of them are common. So I find the same variants in the same ethnic from which I derive from. Okay. Okay, so this is the figure. And of course, there is the genome, the 1000 Genome Project made a browser. We don't have probably time to go through, but you can find the address. So there is a browser in which all the variants that they have characterized are visible on the, as usual, on the plane of the gene. Okay. Just to finish this first part, there is, of course, this other project that was the comparative genomics, and you have seen already the database where all the genomes are present from different organisms. So this is the database. And the only question that we address today is this one. So if there is any relationship between the evolutionary degree, so the organismal complexity, and genome size. This is a, as you can imagine, this is a good point. Why is a good point? You tell me. Okay, put the question in another way. Do you agree with this question? Taking account that at the completion of the Human Genome Project, we had ideas about the genomes of very few organisms. Escherichia coli, and some other prokaryotes, the yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and human and mouse, something like that. And they were so different. I mean, Escherichia coli has 6 million bases as a genome. Okay, the yeast has 12 million bases. Genome. We have 3 billion genome. So the question was logic. Say, okay, there is a degree of relationship between the primitive organism and the evolved organism. When you say evolutionary degree, it's a real difficult story because a geneticist can tell you that, okay, every organism is quite fit in the environment in which he lives. So I am less evolved to live in a, for example, in the deep seas than archaea bacteria or something, of course. But the complexities are not the measure. Probably it's better to talk about complexity instead of evolutionary degree. Okay, complexity means how many functions is an organism able to do. Okay. For example, we say that animals are more evolved than plants, more complex than plants, just because the animal move and the animal learn, animal react to with movement with a different situation and so on. So there is I'm not an evolutionary biologist, so I don't know how to manage this, but you can understand what is the story. Okay, so. When you look at this first review that I saw, that most of you actually have at least taken a look of it, okay, there was one story at the very beginning. They say comparative genome analysis revealed that organisms' complexity scales not with the gene number but with gene regulation. Okay, so they say that there is no with gene number. This is true when you look at the gene number. It's only partially true when you look at the dimension of the genome. Okay? So I have no specific slide about gene number, but just to tell you, if you look, for example, at an organism like model organism that you use a lot, like the worm, Caenorhabditis elegans, that is quite simple, as you can imagine, and it contains, actually, adult of Caenorhabditis elegans is composed of only 1,700 cells overall. So it's not really a very complex organism, but it encodes 19,000 proteins, okay, and we encode 20,000 proteins. So there is not that such a large difference in terms of number of proteins. Okay, when you look at the genomes, the story is a little different, not really completely different, but it's a little different. So here you have classes of organisms here. This is bacteria. This is mammals, and we are there. And this is the scale in number of nucleotide pairs per haploid genome. So we start with 10 to the fifth, that is 100,000, 1 million, okay, 1 billion, 1,000 billions, okay, just to find the places in this scale. And you see that the bacteria are more or less, the mycoplasma have less than 1 million nucleotide large genome. Escherichia coli is there, so 6 million. And most of them stay there. Okay? If you look at the fungi, that budding yeast is there, and you see that we are starting from 10 million and going up to 1 billion. So they are some of these organisms that unicellular. They have genomes that are very close to mammalians, as I mentioned. You see? These are protists, so unicellular organisms as well. They, as you can see, there is a very large range of dimension. They start from 20 millions, they arrive to enormous genomes like this one. The amoeba, for example, has an exterminated genome, incredible, much larger than our genome, and we don't understand why. It's more or less completely repetitive genome. And it's there. The plants as well, the plants start here and arrive to some enormous genomes, like 100 billions exterminated genomes. Okay, some of them are smaller. Anyway, this insect, mollusk, fish are there, amphibians, reptiles, birds, human, mammals. So it seems like in evolution you have a kind of increase of the genome size. Okay, if you try to make average point, okay, and go through, you see a kind of curve like this. So you have an increase of the genome size starting from the unicellular organism to the highest. This is normal. I mean, the number of functions that the bacteria need is nothing as compared to a mammalian, of course. But, as you can see, there is no consensus on the genome size. You have organisms that are actually... there is real no difference in between the complexity of Arabidopsis with the lily or something like this, but they have enormous difference in the size. Okay, so this makes a kind of story that means that some genomes evolved in duplicating without any apparent, because... it's a kind of lack of knowledge, probably, what you say, apparent use of that. Okay. Anyway, that was the last story that I wanted to show you for this part. And since we talked about transposable elements during last lesson, and some of you were quite curious about the story of these mobile elements that replicate and jump all over the genome. I found a very good issue of this journal. This is a journal that hosts only review articles, no original research in there. The current opinion in genetics and development, they have only 4 issues per year that are monothematic. So this is an issue on the genome structure and transposable elements or whatever, and if you want to take a look, there are 2 or 3 very nice reviews on transposable elements in there. Okay, so we can move to the second part, but as I promised, we stop a little bit, 5 minutes, just to tell you something about the mother cell. Mi riposo un attimo. I rest 30 seconds. Okay? Okay, so what I wanted just to show you was this kind of wiki that is sometimes a difficult to manage. So let me see if I can open the. Probably it's better if I sit down here and use it as a computer. Okay. If you have a cell phone or whatever, you can follow me directly on the site, but as you like. Okay. So the wiki is in the very first section. Can you see that? More or less. Let me see if I can ameliorate your. Is that any better? Wait. Tell me when it's good. Can you read it now? Okay. So when you find all these stories in student activities, yeah? It's the very first section up. And you have this first activity that is this interrogation point here, that is students recall material group choice. So when you click over there, you will see all this. Okay, this is my view. You have a different view. I can probably change. Wait. Somewhere I know that I can switch to be a student myself also. Okay. Good. So you see this. Why?
We see the same.
You see the same? Real? Why? This is great. Why? Yeah, no, you have to make a choice over there. Why you don't see the choice? Maybe I understand. Probably because I didn't open it. I return to my normal browser. So let me see. Okay. No, I just didn't open the choice, sorry. I'm changing now. Today we have 11 March, but 2019, right? Okay. Okay, make that 9. And until, it's okay. Okay, now if you load it again, probably you have a choice. Is that working now?
Yes.
Yeah. So, let me act as a student again. Okay. So you have, yeah, so as you can see, there are different subjects. There is also fish that is here, I don't know why, but anyway, it's one of the choices, okay? So just to tell you, this NGS genome sequencing means all the varieties of technologies and methodologies that are used for genome sequencing, like exome sequencing or whatever, okay? And FISH is the fluorescent in-situ hybridization. We will talk about it shortly, okay? But there are many variants. There are immunofish, DNA fish, RNA fish, and blah, blah, so you can explore whatever this kind of stories. And this subject is epigenomics, are all the methods that are used for changes like histone marks or whatever, we will talk next week. And this transcription factor mapping is something we talk in the next week. This is transcriptome, that is the third chapter in the course, and long-range chromatin interaction consensus regulation. And this is post-transcriptional regulation, RNA binding protein mapping. And finally, we have two additional stories here that are a little out of the mainstream of the course, that are the methods to knock down and knock out genes that we were mentioning different times in the lessons, these kind of guys. And genome editing, like the CRISPRs, I don't know if you never heard about. But it's a kind of mediatic concept, genome editing. Okay, so you will see. So, I understand that you probably at the end of this lesson you only heard about these two guys here, but don't choose them immediately. Okay, if you have any other kind of feeling with different technologies, you will choose them after that, no problem. Okay. So, questions? The second story is how to use the wiki. So you have a PDF here that is explains how to do it. Instructions, so nothing really very difficult to explain. Okay. I will show you how the wiki is in a minute. So, and finally the wiki itself. The wiki is there. Okay, here you are a lot of warnings because I know that sometimes something happens. The only important information in this wiki is that this is a collective page. So changes that you make is in the file and everybody can see it. So sometimes it happens that you make a setting or something that actually disrupts the organization of the pages. So be careful before clicking everything, all right? I don't know if you never used this. You never? Okay. It's not really complicated, but it's not very similar to what you are used to, like in Microsoft Office Word. It's not the same. Since it's a database and is used with HTML language and it is adjourned all the time, so you are not to save or something. You have to save at the end, but not during the work. So you have an index page that is this one, okay? And each of these labels goes to the page concerning that particular subject. Why this is in blue? Just probably because I didn't start the page. No, the page is there, okay. So in each page, you have a small, sorry, just to not to make casini, come see. If you have you have this kind of index just to go back. So please don't change it. When you put yourself in edit mode that you have to do for writing, of course you can also change the title. You can also change the index and whatever. Please don't do it. Okay? Okay, you see that this is the HTML writing of going to the index page. So please don't change it. Okay? I can put it again, but I mean it's better if you don't change. And so you start writing directly from here. And as you can see, the text editor is not really something very familiar probably to you. Here you have the size of the character, bold, italics, or whatever the list, and these are to insert links. Okay, this symbol here means to insert a link. Please pay attention to what I am telling to you now. To insert a link, you have to write a text, select it, and then put a link. Okay? So you write whatever, NCBI, okay? Then select, and then insert the link. When you insert the link, there will be a small window that makes you enter in the URL that you copy from the browser and then just paste in inside. Okay? Good. You can remove the link here, and you can insert images, movies, or whatever you want. And here, there is additional editing instruments that you can see. Okay? Try to avoid as much as possible to copy from web pages and inserting the text directly there, because in that case you will insert all the settings from the web page. Sometimes it makes a real disaster. If you want to I discourage copying and pasting in general. But if you want to copy and paste something, please paste it in a text as a text file, so it will lose all the settings, and then you can paste it inside. Okay? Mi guarda com'è. It's not difficult. You copy the text, then open a text from Windows, and any text. Come si chiama? Cosa di text? Not Word, the simple text. The one that makes txt, point txt. You copy there, and then you copy again and put in the page. So we lose everything that is not an ANSI character. And please try to avoid to make pages and pages and pages of description, because today it's very easy to go in Wikipedia has 3 pages, you just paste it and put it there. And I made it my duty. This is not true. If you want to connect with a Wikipedia page, you can just copy the link and put the link over there, okay? Because if I read this page, I want to get information about what Lorentzian chromatin interaction, I don't need to have the copy of the wiki page, just the link is enough, okay? But your work is to try to understand a little bit what you read, okay? So what the technology that you are trying to explain is, and to make yourself a short text, not a long text, a short text. Saying, for example, NGS, we mentioned that. NGS is a technology that allows sequences of DNA and RNA using a short read high throughput parallel sequencing. It has a very high efficiency, it has a very low cost as compared to Sanger. Well, this is enough to description. Then you want to connect with some video or whatever else, you can do it. But try to make yourself a filter and to make a short description. Always think about that your work is read by the other people. So as shorter it is, as will probably most read. This is a general rule for writing things. Long stories, nobody cares about them. Okay. Va bene, questions? You try. If you have difficulties, then okay. Good. So, coming back to the lesson. I don't remember where I put my lesson. Okay, so we can start again. I hope you can survive. Yes, you can. So just to take a look of this start of the chromatin and chromosome and nuclear organization part, which is the one that will continue on Wednesday, and which is the subject of what I hope you could read a little bit. This is your second textbook. This is a review from Pamela Geyer, that is one of the most important specialists in the field, and publishes this paper in 2011. And what is the subject. The subject is that when you look at the nucleus, okay, so we talked about the genomes until now. Sorry, you cannot see anything. Okay. The nucleus, and as you all know, we have nucleolus, or one or two sometimes, and you have dense chromatin and lighter chromatin. Okay, so this is a very old story. Cytologists from 70 years ago, they say, okay, you have your chromatin and heterochromatin. So what we are trying to understand here is a little more about the simple definition of chromatin and so on. And if you look through the text that is in your textbook, you see that they say a very important story. So they say that actually the genomes are divided in chromosomes, as you know. How many chromosomes do we have? Human. How many chromosomes do we have? 23. 2 times 23. You have more? Human have 23 chromosomes 2 times. Okay, 46. Okay. These occupy the finite regions or territories within the nucleus. These chromosome territories, this is a definition, are arranged based on the transcriptional activity and chromatin landscape of domains. Okay, let's go a little bit forward. The first important story is that, but you knew already, is that usually heterochromatin is at the nuclear periphery. Okay, so we know that heterochromatin is usually placed at the periphery or close to the nucleoli, and this heterochromatin corresponds to gene pool regions and silenced regions. So try to put something, some concept on these two words. Gene pool regions. What are gene pool regions? Do you have any kind of idea about one pool region in our genome?
Telomeres.
Any other offer? Centromeres, right. But this is completely correct. Usually telomeres and centromeres are deprived of genes, and they are usually heterochromatic, okay? Constitutively heterochromatic, so always. But in a more general sense, if one time you have some time to spend and go to the browser that I showed to you and explore the genome, you see that there are patches in which there are many, many, many genes, and patches in which there is really nothing. We call them gene deserts. Okay? And actually, so these regions that are relatively poor of genes, they usually, if you look at their place in the nucleus, they are close to the periphery. They're placed close to the periphery. And the same story happens to silenced genes. So to those genes that should not be expressed in a cell type, we reasoned already about this concept. Okay, very often they are placed in the nuclear periphery. How do we know this? Okay. Is that better? Is that any better? This is a figure from your textbook one. No, sorry, not textbook. Research paper one. The one that we will discuss on Wednesday morning. So please read it and study it if you want. Okay. This is just a comparison of fibroblasts and pro-B lymphocytes. And this is a fish. So somebody of you will explain me how the fish, immunofish, is done in the wiki methods. Okay. But making the story short, I use a fluorescent probe probe, so a small sequence of DNA that is complementary to the gene encoding IgG. You know what? Sorry, IgH. But you know what is IgH? You don't?
Maybe immunoglobulin heavy chain.
Immunoglobulin heavy chain. If you don't know a name of a gene, you go to the NCBI gene database I showed you last time, and you know information about it, okay? So this is immunoglobulin. Are immunoglobulins expressed in fibroblasts? Immunoglobulins, what are immunoglobulins? Huh? Antibodies. I ask you again, what are immunoglobulins? Immunoglobulins are antibodies. You know antibodies in the blood? What is the cell type producing antibodies? Beta, okay, B lymphocytes, very good. Okay, try to connect, okay, this is very important. So, fibroblasts never thought in their life to produce immunoglobulins. It's not their job. Their job is different. What do fibroblasts produce? Extracellular matrix. You remember? Connective tissues. Okay? Good. So they do not express IgG loci. Now, if we make fish, so if you make a probe, recognize the IgH loci, locus, sorry. Look at this. Where it is? In the periphery. This is the membrane of the nucleus, okay? This is the nucleus. And when you look in a pro-B, so the precursor of a lymphocyte, look at this. These are central to the... Can you see the figure? This is the periphery of the nucleus. They are central, okay? So this is just an example, but demonstrates that whenever you have a silenced gene, you find it at the periphery. Whenever you have a expressed gene, you find it at the center. Okay? So in this review that you read, there are several new concepts that you have to understand. The first is chromosomal territories. Okay? So each chromosome occupies a specific place in the nucleus. Second, chromatin landscape, that means how the chromatins are organized in new chromatin, heterochromatin. Okay. Transcription is silent domains, that means a domain, a piece of the chromosome that is silent, so it's not transcribed. Transcription is active domains, it's the contrary. Okay. And this is another concept, changes in nuclear position. So whenever you have a gene that is not expressed, but it becomes expressed, for example, because the cells respond to a stimulus or whatever, okay, it will be moved from its original location close to the periphery to the center of the nucleus. Okay? And the final concept is whenever you have an input whatever kind, you have a tissue-specific and nuclear organization and proper transcriptional regulation. So this is a different concept that you can read in your review. So, starting from the first, chromosomal territories. And this is a concept that actually came from fish technologies, okay, because for each chromosome, people in biotech industries developed specific probes. How can a probe be specific to a big chromosome? That's because they selected many, many sequences all through the chromosome, okay, and they mixed it up, and this is a specific probe for the chromosome. And they are very useful for cytogeneticists, people which analyze the situation of chromosome, metaphasic chromosome in disease. Okay? Because one time they only make the GIMSA staining. Probably you learned it about in genetics. Have you ever heard about the GIMSA staining, which makes the bends in the chromosomes? One time, the only tool to recognize the chromosomes was the GIMSA staining. Now we have fish. And fish makes a very nice story, because each probe set for different chromosome has a color, different color. So when you look this is a metaphasic chromosome staining, as you can see, and these are the 23 different chromosomes of our genome that are stained with different colors. Okay, so you can recognize by color, that is much easier than by GIMSA band, but well, a kind of artisanal specialty. It's one of the jobs that is lost today, is recognizing the GIMSA staining in the chromosomes. Okay. But the problem is that metaphase chromosomes are limited to the mitosis, so the metaphases of division. When what happens to the chromosome when they are interphasing? That is 99% of the life or more of a cell. As you know, the chromosomes are not that way. They are decondensed, okay? And so the question is, are they intertwined or intertwisted? They mix up. If you have a fish, you can have a dish of spaghetti, and as they use in the restaurants today, they make tastes of different kinds of spaghetti. You can have spaghetti with the red sauce, tomato sauce, or spaghetti with the pesto, or spaghetti with whatever, and then you can have them like this, and the chromosome is just like spaghetti, you know. But you can mix them up or keep them separate. I suggest to keep separate. But anyway, this is exactly what the nucleus does, okay? Because if you make a staining, this is the image that you get. You can see there, this is the image and this is the reconstruction. As you can see, each chromosome takes a specific place it is decondensed, but not that much to be mixed up with the other ones, okay? And so you have, but this is a very complex thing because they are 46. So try to think about it. It's true that it's not two dimension, it's three dimension, but anyway, it makes a kind of problem to keep all the 46 chromosomes in a good position, especially if you think that usually when we say silent genes and expressed genes, or heterochromatic and euchromatic parts, they are not one chromosome completely heterochromatic and the other one completely euchromatic. There is a part of the chromosome. So you should see these chromosome like things, objects that have a part close to the periphery, another part close to the center. This makes a kind of difficult story to reconstruct. Anyway, this is one of the frontiers of the today of the genome science, to understand how genes are placed in the nuclei. Okay. So result of this study suggests that genomics arranged interdigitated CTAs rather than randomly intertwined chromosomes. What is the difference in between being interdigitated or intertwined? Interdigitated means exactly what you see here. This is interdigitated. So you can penetrate yourself in between the other object without mixing it. I keep frontiers, borders, between one object and the other one. If you intertwine, you go through. Okay? So they are not intertwined. They are interdigitated. And emerging from these investigations, the picture of the nucleus is an order organelle. Okay, it's a very important story. So, the other story is that we talked already last week that some of the genes are expressed and some are not, right? And saying that, we also mentioned the fact that different cells in an organism do different jobs. For doing different jobs, they express different sets of genes, right? sets means groups of genes. Okay. We had an example with this IgH, but probably lymphocytes express thousands of genes that are not expressed in fibroblast, and vice versa. Okay. So, if we assume that expressed genes are in the middle and silenced genes are in the periphery, as we saw before, and we have different cell types, it implies that the organization of chromatin in different cell types should be different. Okay? So, if we look at the organization of the macroscopic organization of the nuclei in different cell types, we have already an idea about it. Devo fare il solito cine del link che probabilmente non funziona. Come vuoi aprirlo col Google Chrome? Okay. Funziona. Wow, okay. So this is an atlas. You know that today we have atlas of almost everything, so no problem. Also the nuclei have an atlas, and they are very different nuclear kind of cells. I cannot even see what is written on. This is gastric mucosa, this is, I don't know, this is, I don't know. I cannot see. But doesn't matter. I mean, they are different electronic microscopies. Can you see that? Electronic microscopies from different kind of cells. And as you can see, macroscopical, they differ. Probably the most remembered examples are different kind of blood cells, like monocytes or macrophages, whatever they have. So different nuclei, but also in this case you can see very different organization. But this is a macroscopic, I mean, this is electron microscopy, is interesting, but it's not, doesn't tell us very much on the point of view of quantitative, right? Because I could, for example, choose different nuclei from the same kind of cells and show you different things, and so this is another electronic microscopic atlas if you are interested in looking through. No problem. But so what I mean is, do macroscopical differences reflect different macromolecular organization? And there was a very old but very interesting paper several years ago that is from this. These are also nice to see because Luis Parada and Tom Misteri, they are probably among the best scientists studying nuclei and chromosome biology and whatever. So this is an old paper, you see, it's 2004. So, but this was the beginning of the FISH technique. So we had started to have this kind of chromosome painting FISH probes. And so they asked this story. So since the genomes are organized in different chromosomes, and each chromosome occupies a distinct nuclear volume in the form of a chromosome territory, so it is unclear whether the non-random spatial arrangement of a chromosome is conserved among tissues or whether spatial genome organization is tissue-specific. So they asked this story. So what they did was to study mouse chromosomes. Okay, this is not human, it's mouse, because it was much easier to derive primary cells. Do you know what is the difference in between primary cells and stable cell lines?
Primary cells come from the animal, while stable are frozen.
So stable cell lines are those that you use most commonly in the labs, okay? But they are immortalized, okay? So very often they derive from cancer, or they are being immortalized by biotechnological procedures, but they are something different from the normal cells, okay? So to study this kind of chromosome organization, the authors were right to choose primary cells, not immortalized cells, because in the immortalized cells the genome is in some way subverted. Okay. So they took mouse cells, different types, and they used 2D and 3D fish to look at the specific chromosomes and chromosome arrangements. And they did this. Probably you have to keep this light off because we have images of this kind. Si può chiudere questa? Succede niente. Eh? Ah, c'è la corda. Wow, bella. Oh, okay. Okay, that's nice. You can see me, but you can see the slides, so it's better. So this is liver cells, this is lymphocyte cells, and this is lung cells. What is lung? Okay, so you see this is a chromosome 5 in the mouse, and this is a fish of specific chromosomes. You see the couple of paternal and maternal chromosomes there. And you clearly see here in these examples that when you look at the liver, chromosome 5 is almost in the center of the nucleus. When you look at lymphocyte, it is still in the middle, but not that center. And then when you see a lung cell, at least one of those is close to the periphery. Okay? So the problem is that whenever I make this kind of pictures, I say, okay, you pictured 500 nuclei because you cultured 500 cells and then took 500 pictures, and you just show me the tree, they show me your which demonstrate your idea. Of course, this is not a good way to go in science. You have to make statistics to be able to see something significant. So what they did was to divide the nucleus in slices. I can also draw something, but it's probably enough if I explain you. Assume that the nucleus is a circle, okay? If you want to know is the chromosome is inside or in periphery or whatever, you can just measure. And to be able to measure in a, say, quick way, they divided the nuclei in circles of the same areas, okay? The most peripheric, then the second most peripheries, then the third, then the second central, and then the central. Okay? So this was just a mask they put on the microscope, on the analyzer, and they counted the hits. Okay? So the result is expressed like this one. You see, they made the 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 slices, so they are the regions, okay, in which the one means the center, and then progressively you go through the last. Of course, these five sections of the circular section of the nuclei are the same area, okay. And then they measured the position of chromosomes. In this example, this is chromosome 15, in different kind of cells. This is the green is liver, red is kidney, blue, dark blue is lymphocyte, light blue is myeloblast, and this is violet small lung, yellow large, and this is what happens at random. So as you can see, this chromosome 15 has a very different distribution in between. For example, if you see small lung cells, that is this violet line here, you see that is mostly distributed in the fifth peripheric circle as compared to the center. Okay, others are evenly distributed. Okay, but this one. So they did the same for all the kind of nuclei from different cells and different chromosomes. And so if you go there, you can calculate, because they analyzed something like 500 nuclei per sample. Okay, so you can make statistics. And as you probably remember from common low-level statistics, whenever you compare two populations, you get a P. You remember what is statistical p-value? is the probability that the hypothesis zero equal is true. So whenever you have a p-value, usually we accept 0.05 as a level of acceptance for significance. So whenever you have a p less than 0.05, you accept the fact that there is a difference in between the two populations, right? So if you, and this is comparison. So you take, for example, li, that stands for liver, against, for example, ki, that is kidney, and you get a green probability, so non-significant. So the distribution of chromosome 15 in between liver and kidney is not significantly different. But if you look at the red spot here, means that chromosome 15 in small lung cells is very different from liver cells. Okay? So if you look at the red and yellow dots here, means these are the kind of cells in which, by comparing, you have a different position of the. Okay? So they did the same story for all the chromosomes, of course. So chromosome 1, 2, 5, 6, blah, blah, blah. Okay? And for each chromosome, they found actually a different position in different cell types. So, okay? That's to make the story short, but it's quite interesting. And also, they made another story. They made a co-staining of different chromosomes. Okay, so using this is relative positioning of chromosome 12 that is in green, 14 that is in red, and 15 that is in blue. And as you can see, comparing different cell types, you see that the relative position is different. For example, you see that this red and blue, that means 14 and 15 chromosomes, they are very often together, they touch themselves, each other. But only in lymphocytes, different cells, you have not this kind of co-positioning of two different chromosomes. Okay, you can look through the paper if you are interested in this story. Okay, this is couple of chromosome, and this again this is the significance level. So, for example, you see that 12 and 14 chromosome 12 and 14, they are close together only in when you compare Li and Li cells, or when you compare Li and Li and whatever. Okay, so you have different kind of results. Making the story short, this is again analysis of position, you see? Position of three different chromosomes in different kind of cells, and you see there is difference in between the different kind of cells. Okay. Anyway, to make the story short and to get what is a take-home message. Okay? Take-home message. Interface chromosomes occupy discrete territories within the nucleus. Okay, so you are convinced about this? Yes. More or less, yes. Second, the position of interface chromosomes is cell-specific. And third, the relative positioning is also cell type specific. Which kind of implication? I mean, thinking about this, which kind of implication can be this this story? Of course, the implication is that the relative position of different genes can be very different in different cell types. And also, when two genes are close to each other, this suggests that they can be regulated in the same way. Okay? So this is something that links to one concept that we made last week when I told you the organization of genes in the, you remember, in Escherichia coli. We were thinking about the operon logic, you remember? Operon logic means genes that have to be co-regulated for a metabolism. They have a single promoter. They are transcribed together, so they are intrinsically coordinated. Okay. But I told you that when we go to eukaryotes, this linear logic is lost. Genes are everywhere in the chromosomes, but you can see that from these results you can emerge something, some suggestion. It may be that genes that have to be co-regulated coming from different chromosomes, they are actually positioned together in the 3D space of the chromosomes. Okay? So that's another concept. So during the next lesson we will discuss this paper that is your research paper number one. Okay. And we will start, if we have time, chromatin structures. This chromatin structure here refers to the many biological differences, biochemical differences that you find when considering heterochromatin and euchromatin. Okay. So we have to go through all this histone modification, acetylation, methylation. I'm looking in your eyes. Everything you know already a little bit? Yeah? Okay. And DNA modification like methyl cytosines, whatever, okay? Histone isoforms, you know, like H3.3, H2AZ, whatever, okay? Just look through, it's a test. Okay, and then we talk about ATP chromatin remodelers, new things, okay? And all the proteins that stay within the chromatin, okay? Most of these subjects are actually in this review. This is the last one that I found in the literature that is sufficiently wide for your use. I mean, all the reviews that are more recent than 2011, they present only applicative stories, so chromatin structure in development, or for example in disease, so these are not general, but this is good enough. Okay, the only thing that lacks from here is histone isoforms, but you can find a good article on Wikipedia that is, I checked it yesterday, it's correct. So you can find it there. Okay. So please have a read of this, okay, if you want, before I don't give you any activity from today to Wednesday, okay. But if you have a little time, just read it through, so we can go speedy next time to review all these kind of stories. Okay. I'm done, as promised. You can have a coffee now. Okay? Good.